coming up on Open Source with Tony Motley. Rich Parada has been a C-suite level executive at multiple corporations. He has unique insights on the secret sauce that makes a company successful, and he also has some ideas about why some others can't get out of their own way.
So for about $1,000 and a small change in how people were being treated and cared for, that organization completely started turning around, starting in the operating machines with blue-collar operators who had not been respected, who had been talked down to, who had been penalized for making a mistake.
Rich Parada knows American culture. He's been a C-suite executive multiple times. What role does culture play in the success of a business? What are some of the best practices that some corporations are missing? Rich Parada has been involved in turnarounds, restructuring, and entrepreneurial startups. And he joins me now to share his informed perspectives. Rich, welcome to Open Source.
Thank you, Tony. Glad to be part of the program.
Rich, how do you see yourself? I mean, if I met you at Kroger and said, what do you do? What would you say?
I would first tell you that I've had a pretty broad career, a lot of different experiences. One of the things I like to do is, though, I love to learn. So all the different experiences I've had kind of follow that trait. And I like to learn from people, situations. I mean, I've had a chance to work in about 35 countries, organizations of all sizes, from entrepreneurial startups, small business, to businesses that are $500 million, $1 billion. I've spent about... I'd say about a third of my life working as a management consultant. I worked for Deloitte Consulting for a while, then a couple other firms. And I've spent the other two-thirds of my career as a line executive working at the C-level in a variety of businesses, mostly technology and manufacturing. Technology, software, IT services providers, and manufacturing tier one component suppliers. So I've been blessed to see a tremendous amount of how business works in the U.S. and then also globally. And, you know, if we met in the supermarket, I would be, you know, keenly interested in your perspective, what you are doing and how you view the world, because I'm a keen follower of people. I think everyone's got their own story and I like to be able to learn about it.
Now, that's interesting that you say that. When you think about the multitude of places that you've been and companies that you've worked for, consulted with, what are the commonalities in terms of a successful operation? What do you see?
So the principles, and I think if you read the U.S. books or, when I was in business school, the case studies, the things that you would go through, the principles have not changed, but even though the buzzwords and the way people describe them have changed. But I really see three principles, Tony, in a successful organization. The first one comes down really to what I would call transparency and communication. And by that, a successful organization, a successful culture is one that has open communication. In other words, if you're going to go look for information, you can get it. People are not hiding information as a means of retaining power. And most of all, people are acting with integrity. And by integrity, I'm really talking about, you know, telling the truth. Oftentimes I hear a phrase that's popular today, you know, speak truth to power. And I agree with that, but I'd shorten it and I would just say, speak truth. As people of faith, Tony, I know you and I know that lying is not our natural language. So if you end up in an organization where not telling the truth, telling half-truth, white lies, deceit is the way that things get done, that's not going to be successful. And that's not a good place for you. So the first principle, transparency and communication. The second one I would say is, does the organization care about people? And it generally doesn't take you very long to discern that, hopefully even in a recruiting process as you come in. But it's the way the organization chooses to treat people. And I'll give you one example. I got called into a turnaround situation in a tier one manufacturer here in the Southeast Michigan area. Myself and a colleague went in, and we went in to help the company. It had been losing money for the better part of 5 years. It wasn't that big. It was about 60 people, about $20 million in revenue, but they had some real issues. So the prior management was asked to step aside, which I think was wise from the owner's perspective. And myself and my colleague got into the organization and tried to learn and take an understanding of, you know, what's unfolding here that is contributing to poor performance. And we went, it was, again, a manufacturing organization. So we walked out to the shop floor. We were running about 20 or 30 horizontal machines making components, you know, for automobiles. And, you know, we talked with a bunch of the blue-collar operators there. Good people, you know, probably had a high school education, didn't go to college, but certainly knew machines, certainly knew quality, certainly knew what they were there for. And as we got to talking to them, we asked questions. We said, hey, you know, what goes on here that you'd like to see changed? And they had a couple good ideas, but almost to a person, one idea stuck out. And when we heard it, we couldn't believe that was the culture they were operating under. Because what they said to us is they said, look, we're wearing uniforms with the company name on it. We said, okay, you know, is that a problem? They said, well, we really don't like wearing them. And worse, we have to pay for them out of our paycheck. We said, well, that's kind of crazy. How did that happen? They said, well, the prior president, the guy you guys replaced, he came back into the shop one day with a customer, and one of us was wearing a T-shirt on that had something, you know, kind of vulgar or crass. And the president, after the customer left, he came back. He said, look, we're changing this. You guys are going to wear uniforms, and we're taking it out of your pay. And so we said, boy, that sounds pretty lousy. These guys are not making a lot of money anyway as machinists. And so we said, well, okay, let's reverse it a little bit. If we were to get rid of the uniforms, how can we be assured that, you know, the folks working in on the machines are not going to wear the kind of clothing that created the program in the first place? I don't think they expected us to ask that question, but they talked, the foreman talked, and they said, look, if you guys get rid of the uniform, we will police ourselves. And if someone shows up for work not wearing something that's appropriate, if a customer came through, we'll ask them to go home. And we just looked at them and said, okay, is that what you want to do? We said, yep. Shook hands. Done. And then the second thing they said is, you know, it'd really be nice to have a couple polo shirts or something with the company logo on it, because we do like to wear those from time to time. We're proud of the organization. He said, no problem. So for about $1,000 and a small change in how people were being treated and cared for, that organization completely started turning around, starting in the operating machines with blue-collar operators who had not been respected, who had been talked down to, who had been penalized for making a mistake. And, you know, I'd love to tell you that everything was that simple, but when I talk about whether or not an organization cares about people, in that particular group, the blue-collar workers were like, management doesn't care about us. You know, they're making us do these things, and it's costing us money. Therefore, you know, we're going to kind of pretend to go through the paces and do whatever. And in 3 months, that and a couple other changes, we had the organization completely turned around. I'd also share one other quick example on people. I did some work in Europe and Eastern Europe a while ago in some manufacturing facilities. And one of the funniest things I ever heard, Tony, and I keep it even to this day. I was working in Russia in a manufacturing facility, and I'm an engineer by training before I went back and got an MBA. So I know my way around a manufacturing floor, walking through, knew a little bit of Russian, not a lot, go through on the tour, talking to people. And finally, one of the workers there, he motions to the interpreter and wants to have a conversation with me. So the guy asks a question, and the interpreter says, hey, the man here says, hey, you don't really understand what's going on here, do you? And I kind of laughed, and he kind of laughed. I mean, that's a universal language. And I said back to the interpreter, tell him I have a general sense, but I'm always happy to learn what is really going on that I haven't seen walking through the factory. And then he said, Tavarish, which is like the Russian for comrade. He said, well, here's the way it works in our factory. They pretend to pay us. We pretend to work. And it was such a funny statement. Russians have a great sense of humor, but in some sense it was true. That was the expectation of their culture. And I have always remembered that, Tony. And I tell you what, even in the U.S., I've come across some places where that Russian proverb seems to apply. There's people going through the motions. And to me, that's a culture where the organization has said, we don't care about people. So those are two primary principles. And I'll stop before I go on to the third, if you have a question.
Well, I mean, I think those are great shares that you've given us. I have a couple of questions. I want to go back to the manufacturing plant in the United States where they had the uniform issue. And I wondered, is it sometimes, is it that simple? And why is management often missing that level of communication that they can solve an issue like that? Why is that?
Well, good question. I actually think the answer is pretty simple, Tony. There's a lot of bad leaders. There's a lot of people in leadership positions that are there. Who knows how they got there? But they're not there for the right reasons. And therefore, they're not going to perform well. And I can tell you, having had a chance to have been a leader in all types of organizations since I was in college, a good leader will recognize another good leader. And likewise, a good leader will recognize a bad leader. And just like you and your profession, Tony, and the work that you've done in communications and television and all the mediums you've worked in, it doesn't take you very long to identify someone working in your field that doesn't know what the heck they're doing, right? So it's the same in leadership. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people, myself included, you know, we have a lot of scar tissue from working for bad leaders. And I think anybody who has leadership capability and really cares about people, you know, it's incumbent on you to step into the gap and try and fix that. I don't know how many people I work with where I might be the first person that was a halfway decent leader for them. And I'm not saying I'm the greatest leader, but at least I care about the people in my organization, and I'm going to do the blocking and tackling and communicate with them and try and tell them where things stand on a regular basis. Some people have never had that experience. And so when you look at a situation like what's happening on manufacturing, it's pretty clear to me the first guy who made that, he wasn't a leader. He didn't think anything about the consequences of doing that, and he didn't care about his people. But to me, the litmus test is the people one. If you genuinely don't care about the people that are working for or around you, then you should not be a leader. Because it's not going to work out well for you, and it's not going to work out for the folks. When you become a leader of a team, at least 50% of the time is going to be spent dealing with or investing in or dealing with people issues. And they're going to be messy because we're human. We make mistakes. If you don't like doing that, if you don't like, you know, rolling up your sleeves, getting other people, help them solve some of the challenges they have and inspire them to go to the next level, then please don't be a leader. Because you will be very frustrated, and the people working with and around you will feel that same frustration.
Is it true that, I guess, if a person can come in a leadership position and increase the profits, that it doesn't matter?
Oh, yes.
Is that what we're seeing?
Yeah,
it doesn't matter? As long as they're making more money, it doesn't matter?
No. Well, let me go back to good question. Can people come in and do it? Yeah, it happens all the time. It depends, and that's why it comes back to the culture of the business. What does that business really value? Does that business value profit above all else? So it doesn't matter if we hire 500 people this year and fire the same 500 next year. Is that what drives it? Or does it value folks who can come in and help contribute to growth and profit, but do it in the right way? I mean, every business wants to grow and expand their market and be able to provide goods and services profitably. That's what leadership wants to do. That's what everyone in the organization should want to do. I mean, I've yet to meet a C-level executive who's not under that type of pressure to perform. But if you're a leader in an organization, your job is to harness and marshal the resources, get the barriers out of their way, and let people do what they can do. And if you're not a leader in an organization, you should be supporting your leader to get those things done. So I don't think if it's a matter of profit at all costs, Tony, then time to go look for some other organizations, because ultimately that culture is not going to care about people.
Are you saying also then, I guess, that if you create the proper environment and develop the communication, there'll be success or growth or benefit to the company anyway. Is that right?
Yes. And that gets to the third principle that I think hasn't changed. But you mentioned something critical to me, which is the blueprint. I believe that every company has a blueprint for their culture. I love working with entrepreneurial companies, because if you set that culture correctly at the very beginning and are able to reinforce that blueprint over time as you grow, you can develop a powerhouse of an organization, somewhere where hot talent wants to come and work, somewhere where you have growth, profitability, and opportunities. So it really takes a market. A long time ago, I worked with Chevron, you know, pretty big oil and gas company. They were acquiring Texaco. And I went in and worked with them for about a year and a half as a consultant on the integration. And I was, Tony, at that time, Chevron was probably 30 billion and maybe 10, 20, 30,000 employees around the world. I was totally impressed with their culture. Whoever set that blueprint at the very beginning, how many years ago, they did a great job, and the organization did a great job maintaining it. They were professional. They cared about people. They cared about results. They, you know, they did the right things. I was very, very impressed. So even today, 20 years on, I'm not surprised to see that they're a terrific organization, because that blueprint for culture was set, maintained, and it enables them to go to the next level. But the third principle that is really key beyond transparency and caring about people is accountability. Any organization, whether small, large, nonprofit, government, you must have accountability. Because if you don't have accountability, then it just becomes almost back to that Russian experience. You have people who are playing instead of performing. And if that is allowed in an organization, then over time, the people who are the hard workers driving results kind of say, well, you know, Jimmy's not working that hard, or Mary's not working that hard, and we're still doing the same. Why should I work that hard to drive these results?
And I'm just curious, because I didn't get that point. It's lost on me. I'm a little slow. We pretend to work.
The accountability point?
No, we pretend to work. They pretend to pay us. What does that mean? I don't get it.
Oh, so in Russia... I'm sorry. So Russia was the worker on the shop floor was essentially saying, here's how it works. We, the workers, pretend to work. We look busy. We walk around. You know, we move machines. We do that. And they, our bosses, pretend to pay us. So in other words, I'm not getting paid very much for this job, but that's okay because I'm just pretending to work.
I got it. Okay. I guess, you know, it's hard to imagine, but I'm sure. And I'm sure it happens here too, in some places.
Oh, it definitely does. It definitely does. You can walk into some places and people gave up a long time ago. You know, they're getting a paycheck that's might be 50, 60, 70% of what their potential is, but you know, they don't get pushed to deliver results in the organization. There's not a lot of performance. There's not a lot of accountability. You see this in sales organizations a lot. You have your top performers that are driving 80% of the sales of the organization. You've got the bottom who are driving nothing, and the spotlight is on those people, and they're probably going to get fired. And then you got the great mass in the middle that, you know, they'll sell things every once in a while. They'll get close to their quota, but they're just playing the game. So, yes, my friend from Russia was very insightful. It just doesn't happen in Russia. It happens here. But, Tony, that's why the third leg has to be accountability. I was in an organization not that long ago where the organization was made up of a series of other organizations that have been acquired. So the company was a serial acquirer. So let's say a company of 50 people was acquired. Those 50 people came into the larger company of 500 people, and now all of a sudden they're in a large organization. Now, they were acquired. You know, there was an exit. You know, they probably did fairly well. They have a job. They're all excited. In their world, as a small company being acquired, they were doing pretty well. They get into the larger organization. They look around, and they see people, you know, maybe not as performance-oriented, or maybe not as goal-oriented, or maybe not driving the same results. And over time, do you think they really perform in that organization? No, they adjust to the culture. And so after 3 or 4 years, you probably wouldn't be able to tell who the folks were that came from a high-performing organization or not, because the culture of that larger organization was maybe just set on, going the middle ground.
Now, as a top level executive, when you go into a new organization, I'm sure it's just human nature. There's some resistance. How do you navigate that when you come into an organization, especially when people fear change, and change is a constant? So that fear is always there. How do you handle that?
Well, and that fear is often valid, Tony. Right? Because remember, a lot of people have scar tissue from poor leadership or bad examples. They don't know. I came into an organization not that long ago. It was one of the largest ones I worked in. We did about $500 million in revenue, and I came in at the C-level. And the first question I asked I had about 45 people reporting to me in this part of the organization. The first question I asked was to two of my direct reports. I said to them, so, you know, this is a pretty significant role in this organization. Both of them had been there for 5 to 10 years. So I said to them, were you guys interested in this role? And if so, are you upset that you didn't have a chance to get it? Right. So, you know, at least have a conversation, try and take it straight on. What was concerning to me is that neither one of them had really been interested in the role or competed for it. So I had to dig a little bit deeper. And basically it came out that they perceived the C-level in their organization as manic, chaotic, and unpredictable. Things happen all the time, and they just kind of caught the pieces and ran with it. And they didn't want any part of that. They wanted to keep their job. They wanted to drive results, but they did not want to get the spotlight on them for actually, you know, more responsibility and what they perceived was kind of a crazy organization. And that was really insightful to me. So I think anytime you come into an organization at the C-level, you've got to ask a lot of questions because the culture was there long before you showed up and the culture will be there a long time after you're gone. So you just need to start understanding it. Secondly, with that group of people, I understood that they had some amazing insights and ideas about changes that could be made in the organization that would help drive growth and help them go to the next level. But they were kind of afraid to bring them out because what they had seen in the past is people who had suggested ideas kind of got shot down if they were seen as anywhat threatening to the existing C-level team. So I learned pretty quickly that this guy's got great ideas. I said to him, look, I'm going to be your champion. We're going to weigh these out on the merits of what we're doing, and we're going to see if we can get some of them pushed through. And then I went about doing blocking and tackling in the organization for their ideas, plus some others I had in my own, to help us drive to a more performance-oriented organization. The good news was we got the performance. There's always some level of resistance, Tony, as well. I think one of the things to consider is it's not what you say you're going to do. It's what you actually do. That's what people are going to remember, and that's what people are going to respond to. So when I came in that organization, I gave them kind of an overview of things that I wanted to do, and they all kind of agreed and sat there politely and nodded their heads. But until about 2 to 3 months passed and they actually learned that I was a person of character and I was going to be open and transparent and communicating with them and I was going to execute the things that I was trying to do, they didn't really believe it. They weren't sure. I love the quote from St. Francis of Assisi, and obviously as a preacher, his quote at the time was, "Go out and preach the gospel. Use words if necessary." So when you're C-level in an organization, you are always being watched for your behavior. Are you going to do the things you said you're going to do? Are you going to reinforce the culture? And how are you going to treat the people? So one example stood out for me. It's probably about 6 weeks in. The organization had not performed on its revenue goal for the month. And the finance team, the team I was working with, they're really worried about it. So I said to them, why are you guys worried about it? I mean, the last I checked, we don't have any role in going out and selling products and services, and we don't have any cost associated with getting in the market. And they're like, yeah, but, you know, management is always upset at the financial results. I'm like, okay, well, let's put the spotlight back on the people who are actually driving those results. And our role here, we're just kind of reporting them and trying to make it happen. So we get into one of the executive meetings, and it went just like my team thought. People are getting upset, voices are raised, fingers pointing. And at one point in the meeting, I said, hey, we're reporting the information and the data, but I think you need to talk to the sales team if you're displeased with the revenue numbers that we have for the month.
Don't shoot the messenger.
My team was like, yeah. My team was like, wow. And the sales team was like, we're used to the finance team taking all the hits. And I just turned it around because the accountability needed to be with the sales team, not with the finance team. I actually had to, one of my team members was actually explaining why sales were behind in this sector and this sector. And I said, stop. The last time I checked, you don't have any responsibility for running sales in those sectors. we're responsible for making sure we capture revenue correctly. We put the financials together. It's consistent month to month. It's good for reporting purposes. We can sign off on audits. But we're not the ones that are driving those sales. And then the sales guy said, well, but you guys are working the forecast. I said, yes, we are. Forecast coming from you and your group and your team.
Yeah, forecast is based on the numbers, basically. I mean, those projections are based on that. So how did you, and I know you've read about how you've instituted some change there and actually made or saved 50 grand, something like that. Tell us that story.
Oh, yeah. No, a lot. That organization had been running flat on its revenue for 3 or 4 years, Tony. We were able to drive significant top and bottom line growth. But it started, back to my example, that was when my finance team started believing they actually did have a leader who was a champion and who would take the hits at that level and protect them and give them the opportunity to stretch out and put these other ideas in play. And it was very satisfying for me about 20 months later when one of my head guys, the VP of finance, he came to me and he said, you know what, Rich, we have gotten more done in the last 20 months than we have in the prior 6 years. And I said, hey, thank you. But first of all, this was a team effort and you guys always had the ideas of what to do. You just needed someone to be a champion for putting those forth. So we were able to not just make our own part of the organization perform, but the entire organization perform by trying to take a stronger approach towards the culture. And I'm sorry, Tony, the question you asked me was around the length of time it took.
Yes. How long did it take?
It was probably a 3 to 6 month journey for the organization.
That's fast. That's fast. In a corporate situation,
again,
it
comes back to transparency and communication, Tony. I believe that no matter whether you have good leaders, bad leaders, whatever in an organization, when you start putting facts on the table, the facts speak for themselves. I mean, who's it? Rasheed Wallace, right? Ball don't lie. You know, it's either in the hoop or somebody stole it off you. But when you start putting facts on the table, they're hard to look at. And I have a strong passion to be hard on the problem, not the people involved. So even in this instance that sales was down for the month, I wanted to be hard on why was our sales down, not on the sales team and all the things they were doing, because I knew they were working hard. But let's be passionate about why we solved the problem. In this instance, we found that our forecasting was way off. And, you know, well, nobody likes to hear that. Okay, how do we adjust that so we don't get ourselves in the same situation in the future? So I've just found when you start putting facts on the table, it helps. And that's, again, why accountability is so important, Tony, because when you start changing an organization, the first thing that most people will do who are trying to, you know, get it their way or push their own agenda, they'll question the data, or they'll question the people bringing the data, or, you know, they'll just keep running at it. And you've got to stay strong in that and make sure that you're giving kind of unvarnished, unbiased facts of the situation so everyone can see the problem clearly and start to solve it. And then change can start unfolding. I've been in organizations where it's so vague. It's so, hey, well, he doesn't really own that. It's like 3 or 4 people. If you don't have single point accountability, your organization is not going to perform.
Now, we started off this conversation. You talked about your career, your experience in business school. You talked about the vernacular, the catchwords. And those things have changed, but the principles are the same. You were in business school a little while ago. I'm just going through it now. And you're right. This thing about branding has always rubbed me the wrong way. Everybody now is talking about branding. It's a catchphrase. But what you've talked about today is a reflection of branding, which is people learn that when Rich comes in, he does what he says he's going to do. It's the brand. Your brand is who people think you are when you're not
right.
around. And you can't fake
right.
that. So I think that's right. important. That's what the accountability and transparency that you talked about really is.
Yep. And the concept is not a new one, right, Tony? I mean, you're seeing it in B school now. I saw it in B school 20 years ago, lived through it in my career. That transparency, sometimes people call it character, you know, doing what you're doing anyway when no one's looking. That's who you are. That's your integrity. That's your reputation. And as an individual in an organization, even as a company, that brand, that reputation is critically important. But there's all, you know, there's lots of folks who have written on this. One of the books I like the best is Patrick Lencioni, who's written a all slew, but The Five Temptations of a Leader, and going into the ways that leaders fall into traps. As an example, one of his is, you know, you prefer to be popular more than you prefer to make the right decisions. A good leader knows they can't be popular. And if your brand is, hey, I'm going to be popular, and, you know, well, that's only going to get you so far, because eventually you're going to run across situations where, you know, you make a decision that might not be a popular one, or it's going to get made for you. Either way, it's not going to reflect well on you. But I also think there's a lot of good material from Peter Drucker. You know, there's a lot of good thinking that has gone into this area. The hard part is actually doing it. And I think that's the challenge for any leader in an organization. How do you make the right call? I'll give you one other example, because this is a tough one personally for me. But it's very important for the culture. In most organizations, you have some level of hierarchy, right? You got the C-level, vice president, senior director, director. And especially in the millennial time, the time we're living in now, where transparency and open communication might not necessarily respect normal hierarchical boundaries, it's even more important to reinforce the culture. So as an example, I had back to a different organization, I had someone two levels below me that went to talk to my boss about an issue that they had shared with me, which was fair, but they didn't get the response that they wanted. And so they went to my boss, the CEO, to see if they could get a different answer than the one that I was giving them. What my boss should have done is said something like the following: hey, I've given Rich responsibility for this area, and he's accountable for what comes out of it. So if you've already had a discussion with him, you know, I trust he's making the best decision for the organization, so you're going to need to work with that. In this case, my boss didn't do that. He, you know, he listened to it. He thought it was a serious issue. We all got together. Ultimately, he understood the issue. He saw it the way I did. And I didn't take it out on the person in my organization, but it just was one of those things. It's like, hey, we just spent 6 weeks going through an issue that I had the responsibility for initially. My boss could or should have backed me up, so we didn't spend the last 6 weeks going over something that wasn't going to change. But I know I've done the same as well. You know, when someone's working for you, you know, when their subordinate comes to you with a question, you know, our temptation is to solve the issue or fix it, when it really should be, hey, you know, I know you're talking to me and that's good, but you report to John. Did you talk to John about this? Yeah, but he wasn't. Okay, well, look, I've given John authority to work with these, and he's being held accountable for those results. So if that's the conclusion John came to, that's the conclusion we really need to work with. Now, that's very hard, building, keeping and reinforcing that culture in that organization. But you can see what type of slippery slope it is. If people all of a sudden get the idea that, hey, anybody can go to the CEO or your boss or whatever and talk about stuff that they don't like, you're not going to perform as an organization. Now, of course, this doesn't apply to whistleblower issues or harassment issues or things that occur in the organization. Most organizations have a channel for doing that, and that is always appropriate. But I'm just talking about normal day-to-day strategic operational business issues. That's one I know that every time someone comes to me like that, I have to remember, hey, I have delegated authority to people in my organization. They're accountable for it. I got to let them work and go through these things. And sometimes it ends up well, sometimes it doesn't. But that's what delegating and holding people accountable is for.
Does that
make sense?
Yes, it sounds like what people accuse the Dallas Cowboys of, but I don't want to go there. As we wrap this up, we're in a new day now. And so people are working from home and not working at all at some point. So there's been a little bit of a change. How do we get back to business now in terms of corporately? What do you think is important for leaders to consider now moving forward?
Well, I think it's a great opportunity to step back and look at the changes that have occurred and think of ways that you need to reinforce your culture. So back to the principles: transparency in communication, caring about people, and accountability. Is your organization weak in any of those areas? And by having people working remotely or in a more distributed manner, is that going to affect how you perform? Can it affect your culture? Yeah, absolutely. How are you going to continue to communicate you care about people and you're willing to invest in them when maybe you don't see them on as frequent a basis? Maybe you have an organization and it wasn't that transparent and open in communication to begin with. Well, now's a really good time to determine, how am I going to fix that? You know, maybe I need to have more succinct meetings. And by that, I mean a meeting with an agenda and a purpose and an outcome to communicate. Maybe I need to have more all hands meetings so the organization can hear things from leadership, but also ask questions. And then lastly, on the accountability front, look, it's very difficult. I personally believe that when you have people working remotely, you're going to have productivity drop. Now, at the end of the day, we're all knowledge workers, right? We should be measured on output and results, not necessarily how much time we put in. But I think it's important to be able to communicate to a remote workforce. Look, maybe we've been a little loose on the outputs or results we want you to drive, but let's sit down and lay them out clearly. So whether you think it takes you 20, 30, 40, or 50 hours a week to deliver these results, let's have that conversation. I also believe that people can be more productive when you don't have to commute somewhere and, you know, you can be around your family or do other things. But I think for leaders, it's time to evaluate and refine some of those things. And if your culture is not strong in those areas, think about how to prop it up. Because there's one thing for sure in this time, Tony. If you're not a high-performing organization, eventually the clock is going to run out. Because the challenges of how you work with your people have just changed. And I'm a big believer in teams. I believe that people and teams will outperform an individual 90% of the time. So you got to make sure you get those teams together to be high-performing.
Awesome. Rich, I really appreciate it. I mean, what you shared today, somebody should be paying us for this conversation. But anyway, no, it's really good stuff. And, we could talk all day about business, about transparency, about productivity. And I'm sure we'll do it again. And I really thank you for spending a little bit of time with the open source audience. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Tony. Take care.
We'll talk to you guys next time. Like the show, share the show, tell a friend. Open Source with Tony Motley is a production of Duet Digital Media and McLaughlin Media.